Okay, so welcome to the third ever SAGE seminar. And today there are going to be two talks by Alex Klemischa, who's here, and Bob E. Marita, who's there. And the first talk by Alex is going to be on really two things. One is a package he wrote for doing mathematical visualization. And the second is a bunch of examples of this package in the context of number theory, particular kind of continued fractions type stuff. So basically, it's about drawing really cool pictures that have something to do with number theory and use a computer. So, there. So, here's your talk.
Hello, how's it going? Here's a basic outline of what I'm going to talk about. So 2 months ago, I came up here to Seattle and started working on SAGE with the motivation of making some kind of graphics functionality that was worked well. So let's see. Okay, so our desire. So we were jealous of other computer algebra programs like Mathematica and MATLAB. We wanted SAGE to have excellent graphics capabilities too. So we looked around the internet and came across different things. Nuplot was a good package, but as you can see, the license isn't as open as we'd like it to be, so I kind of ruled that out. Pix, I guess you say it, looks good from their examples on the website, but...
Pix is a Python package.
Yeah, it's all written in Python, and seems good.
What's P and GS?
PNG
kind of like
files.
GIFs or JPEGs? Sorry. Image files?
Just image files, yeah. And then SVG is scalable vector graphics, another image file type. So it's not ruled out yet, but we're not using it as of now. But matplotlib is something that looks very nice, and that's one we decided to go with to make an interface around. So matplotlib comes with it's a library for doing graphics, and it's written in Python. And comes with a lot of classes that do a lot of things. And I looked over all of them, kind of learned how it worked, and kind of modeled a plan of attack on wrapping these classes and making a usable interface from SAGE. It kind of has a feel of Mathematica like. So if you're familiar with Mathematica, definitely get going pretty quick. And as of now, the matplotlib the SAGE interface to matplotlib can output PNG files, PS or EPS for writing papers, PDFs, and SVGs. Hopefully, if you guys see the browser interface, SVGs for web browsers, and it could be really cool because you can kind of just like text, you can kind of click and it just enlarges right there. So,
cut and paste pieces on. So.
Yeah, so in the future, hopefully.
The problem now is that it seems like most web browsers have really crappy implementations of viewing SVG. We tried a whole bunch and only Conquer seemed to do anything that made sense, really. But maybe that will improve.
Maybe that'll improve, yeah.
Where do you encounter SVG files?
I've never encountered them before.
That's
right.
But they're neat. So if you make any plot, you can have it outputted as an SVG file in SAGE, and then you get this XML file. Remember they talked about XML last time? You get this file, and at least certain web browsers will allow you to view it and scale it really nicely and copy bits and pieces. And it's the wave of the future, I guess. But
it looks
I've
like
never
that's
encountered one before.
That would be included in a LaTeX document or something like that. This is a, something for a viewer, is that the idea?
Yeah, I think so.
For a browser, yeah.
For a web browser. How do you stick graphics in the web browser nicely? This is the way.
It's an image format that isn't, it's kind of the, one of the biggest free image formats that's not pixel-based. Like you're pinging in your JPEG, you get for graphics. Like you zoom in and you just see the pixels are. The SVG is, you know, it just says, oh, there's a line from here, and if you zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, it's still a line.
So here's how you make one in Sage. You just make a plot and then save it as something.svg. So you save it as a.svg.
Okay.
Sorry, it keeps going. So gotta be useful at some point. So now I've now created a file, a.svg. 49k, it's a plot of the sine function. And you can actually just look at it. It's plain text.
So that's the file.
Yeah, and it like has every single point. It's this massive, massive thing. This is one point in the graph, I guess. I don't know. I'm actually, maybe those are the little tick marks. I don't know what they are, but I think they're the points in the graph, though. It's a very verbose format. And then you can view it, and Conqueror, at least, views them nicely. So if I type conk a.svg, in a second it pops up, and so there's a little piece of the sine function. It's just the beginning. But so you can scale in and out and stuff, yeah. And but somehow it's just more flexible in the long run.
You don't lose any quality.
Right,
yeah.
When you scale in.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't lose quality.
You don't necessarily lose
not
quality.
Resolution type.
Yeah.
So for the browser interface, that would be excellent if it was...
When it
works well.
Yeah.
It would be awesome.
It's not really a safe problem. It's just, it's nice to have that in the future. It's the analog of, I think it's like the analog of math ML, but for graphics, kind of. That's in right.
Okay, so here's what users or anyone using Sage, the functionality that exists now, and if you've seen Mathematica, it has the same kind of feel. F is a function, parametric plot, two functions, capital L is a list of data. If you give it a list of one-dimensional data points, it kind of plots your points with respect to how long your list is.
Is it a spline or what is it?
It doesn't connect the points.
Or doesn't connect them.
Yeah,
just
plots
them.
What's a point?
It's a dot. Okay.
What's a dot, basically. And the graphics primitives, also a Mathematica feel to them, but they kind of do, they're the back end of how we do like list plot, just a bunch of points and connecting lines and strings, and right now strings you can put in some pseudo tech, or it's not really real tech, right?
It's like a subset of tech.
It's like a subset of tech, so you can kind of make some tech labels for your graphs. So once you plot something or make a graphics primitives, there's different ways of viewing it. Show right now is in Linux it pops up a web browser. In Windows it pops up
picture and fax viewer, whatever you have set up.
Yeah, whatever you have set up
to be the default viewer for that file, for PNG files. And in OS X it uses the open command.
And graphics array is another way of kind of plotting images on one large image, kind of.
Sine, cosine, together, and I'll show an example of that later.
But that's very convenient. Okay, so how do you make functions to plot them? Here's a simple example. There's two ways that are about the same. The regular way, I guess, to do it is define a function of a variable and return. Well, here I'm returning the real part of the zeta function, complex part. And the second way of doing it is with lambda functions. It's a little more Triptych, I guess. But they give the same end result. You kind of call them with a number, and they return the value.
And something is plotted, or what?
Yeah. So either one. I'm gonna give an example of plotted, but
these are things you give as. Once you define the function, you give it as input to the plot function.
Okay.
Yeah, so any one of those, can I go back?
Could you give like the equivalent of one of these in Mathematica or something? Give the equivalent of defining CRF, but in Mathematica, as far as the notation goes. Because you probably know Mathematica, right?
Yeah.
Or people all know Mathematica.
In Mathematica.
This is how you define all functions in Python, basically. But it's the equivalent of this.
So this is the Python syntax for defining functions.
Yeah. Exactly. All the rest of them.
But it's
basically like that is.
So two different ways, same thing as that. So that could be plot F, that could be any of those. Yeah.
And the reason you use lambda is because often you want to type the function in right there. You want to define the function right there when you're calling the plot function, without having to define it up above.
Yeah, and it's
put it in the plot.
Yeah, you could say plot of, I guess, lambda t colon
so
t squared or something.
You have to do the define.
Yeah, exactly. It just puts it all in one place.
Okay, which is a little darker here, but so those are the two first functions right there, plotted together. You can do arithmetic on these functions because they're object-oriented. They're object-oriented. So they have methods where you can add them together. That basically means form one larger graphics object out of two smaller ones. So add them both together, and together they also have a save method. And saving it, there's several different options.
So you plotted the real and imaginary parts of the zeta function on here from -25 to 25.
Yeah.
So you can see the trivial zeros of zeta. I guess. Because that's where the two graphs come together at zero.
Yeah, at 14. Well, here's a better example. So here's the the second two lambda functions. I use them so they can be used in the same way. There they are, there's the first and the second one. I use it like a parametric plot, so I'm plotting x and y in the plane, the real and the imaginary part, as points in a plane with the zeta function.
Okay, and it's t is very
important. Yeah, it's t. So that's kind of cool, pretty useful, pretty simple. But several options to change. So whatever extension you give, you can give like zeta p EPS. It looks at the file extension, gives you EPS file, same for SVG. And the rest, changing the min, the max, can change the axes. And
for all the graphics primitives, the optional arguments are basically the same as in Mathematica, except they're lowercase with underscores instead of uppercase. What percent of the Mathematica options did you implement?
One third.
Okay.
So if I enter that command in Sage, does the plot appear in a different window, or where does it appear?
So in the web browser interface, it would be right there.
Except the web browser interface isn't available, right?
It's getting there.
What?
It's getting there.
Okay, but
it's
right
much
now,
more available.
Without the web browser.
So right now, just if you do save, it would just
save will just
file.
Save it to a file.
In that
if you say show, it'll pop up in your web browser.
So this P3, that instruction doesn't produce anything to work with.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
But once you
can actually print out P3 and it'll print information about what's in the plot, like how many points there are and stuff.
That'd be useless.
Yeah, exactly. It'll tell you there is a plot with this many points in it.
Yeah. The real generation, putting the ink to the paper happens when you call the save method with a file name marker, yeah. or without.
And until that point, it hasn't used matplotlib at all.
Yeah.
It only uses matplotlib when you call save.
Or Dutch, or show.
Yeah, or show. Show just calls save, and then shows the result. Yeah.
Okay, so that was marginally exciting. Here, getting into a little more of the fun part. So here's a little Diofante equation-esque statement. Let you read it over.
That's weird.
So taking the first four of those primes to satisfy this condition, congruent to 1 mod 4. In Sage, I construct a number field.
What's the primes 30 mean?
Oh,
the for first 30 primes?
Yeah, if this condition is met. Are you aware of that? The minus sign?
No, I'm happy with it. It's just, it's a little weird because you're squaring. But that's okay. That's fine.
I
never actually.
This is all.
I mean, every number p congruent to 1 mod 4 is a sum of two squares, and then you're taking that representation and sort of squaring it to get the.
This statement right here?
This is a sum of two squares.
This is kind
of. I'm just seeing why the proposition is true.
Well, I'll prove it to you with a picture.
Primes 30 just means all primes up to 30.
Yeah, I figured that out.
Yeah.
It's technical, it's actually a generator, so when you say for p in primes of something, it doesn't actually make a list of all of them. It just
checks to see if it's in there.
Well, it sort of does 2, then 3. It keeps using next prime to get the next prime. So it doesn't waste memory.
Yeah, it doesn't use
all the memory. It's like a lazy iterating to the primes.
So here is empty graphics object, empty list. I loop over those four primes in that list, factor the integer, factor p in k, square it, make a list out of it. So that's a line, graphics type line. Graphics
triangle.
Is a graphics type text. Add to the empty list, and also add to the empty graphic. At the empty list and the empty graphics object. And you get triangles. Because they're. So basically, at these points, I'm going from 0, and here are the 2 points, the first and the second, A and B. So, slightly silly example, but kind of interesting.
Could you go back on the screen?
Which part?
Right here. Here's the actual numbers that I'm plotting. That make a line. Just to form a triangle. A Pythagorean triangle.
The line function connects a bunch of points despite it. I thought that was disturbing because I thought line should be straight.
I'm confused with the squares. Why are you plotting the squares and not the...
That's a good question.
I mean, the triangle is not, coordinates are not the squares, they're the points. Squares are the squares of the lengths, right? So what is the square doing? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I wish I had is the web interface going? Here, well.
Yeah, because you label, actually if you look at the labels, they'll be different than the position
yeah,
actually appearing.
So that may be an error in my cutting and pasting to make into a PDF.
Well, no, you shouldn't have squares on the LV line.
What?
That's wrong. And the line says LV equals, the square shouldn't be there. Because if you look at the label that you actually put in the next slide, like go to the next slide. There's no label. Okay. But if there was a label, it would have much smaller numbers than what it says it has. Where it says it's being labeled. Yeah, like there. See where it says 5, 12, 13 in the upper right? That triangle has side means 25, 144,
yeah,
69. So you've squared your triangles.
Whoops, yeah.
You squared the triangle.
That's where I found.
Yeah, you're right. All right.
I squared my triangles. Sorry.
Okay. That answers the question. And then you need to fix it. Okay. So it still illustrates graphics right there.
Yeah. And that's a cut. You can load this up in the web interface and tinker with all these examples. So. Here is another example per William. So, sage functions, elliptic curve, get the coefficients out of it. Now right here I color points blue if they're not prime, red if they are prime. Right here, do two, I add on to this graphics type, which I started right here. 2 square root of 2, and I save these different files, different names. And so the right one's the all primes, they're red, and the left one is blues or non-prime. So that's kind of the best example. And here's the last kind of fun example that I've been playing with that Willie and I were talking about earlier. Pretty interesting. So I take a constant and I loop over a lot of points, integer points. I take the point x and y, and I plot it with some different color. And so it produces spirals, and a spiral outward, because k is getting larger.
What is the range?
It goes from 0 to 1,000 minus 1. Yeah. And they're all integers. So 2 pi ck. So if any of those c's are a rational number, as it loops around, you see arms appear, because and the arms are exactly the denominator amount. So here's for c equals 1 over 5, and here's for c equals 37 over 41. So there's 41 arms there. And so, can anyone think of what would happen if C wasn't a rational number? What would happen to those points? So if C is not a rational number, you see these beautiful patterns appear. And if you kind of stare at this, in here, it's really high quality and stuff. So you see these points; they never form straight arms. And this is for c equals the irrational number square root of 2. And here's another one for the c equals the golden ratio. And I'll have that available. So it's pretty fun to change the colors and see how it changes with different values of C. And that's about it.
Wait, no, is it?
Huh? That's it.
Don't you have to... Well, I should say the number, like in these graphs, you can sort of count how many spirals there are, and that is the same as the denominator in like the first two or three continued fraction convergence to the number you're looking at. So we also, like it's really interesting to plot these for like e cubed or e to the 4 or e to the 5, some funny transcendental number, because you get very clearly distinguished like 7 spirals. Here, show you. Wait, actually I can't because you need that big chunk of code that you need to paste in to draw this, but it looks just like,
If you do it, I think for Pi, maybe it is. You just get what looks like 7 different spirals. Also, what you get is like just 7 spirals. It's hard to. I don't know if they don't cross over, but you get 7 spirals.
It looks really, really like 7. And if you look at the continued function of Pi, of course, one of the convergences is 22 sevenths. And that means that what he's doing is he's taking the number e to the 2 pi ic and taking powers of it, and then how far you are from the origins, just giving you information about what iterated is. So e to the 2 pi I pi is pretty close to e to the 2 pi I 22 sevenths. And so it's sort of a picture you get similar to the picture you get for a 7-3 of unity. But I think if you were to draw this picture at a very high precision and draw a huge range of I, then it wouldn't look much like 7 anymore.
Yeah,
it
would
look like whatever the next one is, yeah. Even though you don't see it at all at the computer, it really looks like 7, and that's what it's going to be forever. Very, very clearly. It would be good if you could draw it for Pi. Can't you just paste? I think you can just paste it out of this code, or is it? It's just this code right here, right?
Yes.
So, tool, select tool. That's a pretty good cut and paste here. Damn it, it's too. It looks really neat because it's so misleading. speak text. Let's see. There it is. So make C. So here's this example. Oh, that's wrong. Invalid syntax. Oh, these quotes are wrong because they're quotes for tech rather than quotes for Python. Draw axis.
Oh, sorry. That's very new.
Okay. It's not in my version. Yeah, okay. So this is just, you can see it a little more clearly here. And this is for the one with 41 different things. At the beginning, it looks really spirally for some mysterious reason. But then what if we change this to pi? I guess I can put pi like that. So if you count, it looks like, okay, it's exactly 7 spirals, right? And indeed, if you look at the continued fraction convergence for pi, so convergence of the continued fraction of the some real approximation to pi, you get 22 7 spirals. But if you were to draw this much, much longer, you'd get actually 106 different spirals. That's what, you know, eventually it would look like, wow, there's definitely 106 different spirals there. You know, somehow it would, this stuff right here would just look like that at the origin. You'd have 106 or whatever. And then if you did it even farther, you'd have 113 and then 33,102 spirals. And the spiral pattern kind of looks like something you see in nature, I think. Anyways, I plan to
especially
add
the one for
some illustrations.
The golden ratio and stuff.
The fraction section of my number 3. Oh yeah, do the golden ratio.
Yeah, golden ratio. Nice. Which is really nice.
Oh, yeah, it was a constant.
That's more reason to use it. Admit it.
Good idea. It's a symbolic constant. All the number 3 constants. Oh yeah. And so you wonder, how many are there? So just wait, put the continued fraction in the bottom. Like, in the next thing,
the
continued fraction. And just put golden ratio there. And the reason is just that the denominator of the continued fraction is telling you a root of unity that's very, very close.
Is that a defined constant?
Yes.
Ratio is?
Yeah, well, there are a whole bunch of constants. That was Alex's
first
package when
he said it.
So I think there are 34. I think that's the approximation that you're really noticing in this range. So when you count it up, you get 34 different spokes in the graph. So he was sitting there this morning. He was sitting there counting how many spokes there were. He said, "You're going to get 34."
So
it's pretty fun.
It's hard to count.
Yeah. It's really. There's got to be like a cool presentation of continued fractions from the point of view of drawing these pictures. Have you ever seen this sort of thing? Maybe with the pictures?
Yeah, I've actually had some students write their little term papers on things like
that. On exactly those pictures?
On the pictures, right.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah, there's some references in places like the Mathematics Magazine or the Mathematics Gazette that have little articles on this.
Cool. Very good.
endlessly fun.
I like your reference because I
there, wouldn't there's, put it there's a, there was an article that appeared in something like the Journal of Science some years ago where somebody tried to give a biological explanation for this, but it didn't come off very well.
Yeah, I bet.
He did have a mathematical appendix to it, but eventually it looked like it was fudging a lot. I mean, you'd have to talk about how things grow and crowd things out and so on, and it started not to make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, great. So,
but it started to sound good until you got into the nitty-gritty details of it, and it looked like the mathematical model wasn't all that believable for why you get Fibonacci numbers and all this stuff.
Whoa.
Anyways, okay.
Okay, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
So any questions for Alex about where this
curious
is going
on? Can you make a function that answers a point on that?
Just one point?
Wait, well, no, position? So you have define a function that returns a point, this is valid.
A graphics.
No plot function. So what would that mean? I mean, how do you plot a function out these points? Is a point a real number?
I guess instead of passing two functions, imagine you had a function that gave the x and the y.
Oh, that's a good question.
Wait, say?
So you give a vector value.
Yeah, you give a vector valued output and then plot that.
I don't think there's...
Yeah, very much.
But you have to define like two or three functions separately.
Yeah, do you have that? Can you do parametric graphs but where you give as input a single function that outputs pairs?
Yeah, no, I thought of that. I thought about that.
What do you have?
I don't know. I mean, is that something that's wanted? It's interesting to think about. Like,
so we just give the function twice with two square brackets, but then it would waste time as it would compute twice as much. Yeah. I think it could be an efficiency savings.
Yeah, it could be. Because some of these, when you plot several thousand points, it takes a long time, so it definitely could be an efficiency thing.
So, I mean, the obvious missing piece here is 3D graphics.
Yeah.
And there are three plans for that, I guess. One is Matplotlib has some preliminary 3D graphics support, but we're not sure how good it is. It looks like it'll scatter plot a bunch of points in 3D space and that's maybe do a surface, I don't know. I mean, kind of the really easy stuff. So that's plan one. PIX claims to have some 3D output support, but PIX is pretty limited. Like, it doesn't even output PNG files, it just outputs EPS files. And then, so those are two things. And the third is to do the 3D graphics thing, like a video game type. 3D interactive simulation of graphics. It's not as silly as you think because there's something called Soya 3D, which is a video game programming library for Python. You can very easily set up something where you draw a surface and you can physically just move around on the surface and you like click on a point and it would tell you the tangent plane. It must be like a 3D shooter game, but exploring algebra and
surface.
Must have maybe we should profess this for the Boeing thing as a student project. Boeing would like it.
I just wanted to make like Doom, but in hyperbolic space.
Yeah. Can I actually have a little demo like that here, where you move around some surface?
Any other questions?
Any other graphics? Okay, great. So thank you.
Thanks.
I'll get you right. So next, Bobby is going to talk about something that people have been constantly asking for, but they don't have. So basically, wouldn't it be nice if when you wanted to install Sage on a machine, you say dpackage install or apt-get install Sage. Wouldn't this be nice?
Yeah, it won't work right now.
Wouldn't it be nice if you could say apt-get install Sage? That would be great. Because then anybody who has an Ubuntu or Debian system could just do that. And what if it wasn't just for Ubuntu, but for all the Linux distributions? Obviously, that would be nice. And Bobby's first assignment, should he accept it, which he seems to have done, is to implement exactly this. Okay, so, oops, what the heck?
Okay, so I'm Bobby, and like Boom said, I'm going to talk a little bit about trying to get Sage working inside of a mainstream Linux distribution.
Never mind me.
So how many of you have used Linux before? How many of you use it regularly? So most people here have used, or maybe OS X, well, that's too short. In the Windows world, there's the way you build software is completely different from the Unix world, especially in Linux, where almost everything, the source is out there, and you don't have to pay any kind of fee to obtain that software. But there's a bit of a headache, though. There's still a cost, because you have to build the software somehow for your system. And so the standard way in Unix is to, so we use this thing called autoconf, and I just got the book from William now, so hopefully this process will be built more smoothly. We can figure out how to make Sage a little bit more standard, because it's not exactly standard like this right now. So you execute this configure script, which tests the functionality of the requirements for the package you're working with. And it should generate a make file. And that make file is used when you call make, which builds the application. So it runs the compiler, does all that sort of thing. And then traditionally, you also have a make install, which moves the software that you just built into the correct directory so that it can be run and used. And so yeah, it has to set permissions and do things like that. So how do we build Sage right now? Well, what you do right now is you download Sage, untar it, which is the Unix archiving system. You run make, and there's no configure script. And bam, Sage is done. You're ready to run it. And you run it in the directory that it was built inside of. You can run make clean and get rid of like 500 megabytes of junk that was used during the build process, but that's about it. And you're good, yeah, so it's as simple as that. Make, run Sage.
How big is that
area? Once you do this, I think you recommend like a gigabyte of free disk space.
850 megabytes to build Sage.
So a fair amount of disk space free, but then you can make clean and...
You can basically type make clean as you go and end up... If you build for a while and you hit Control C and stop it because you're about to run out of disk space, then type make clean. Then type make again, it picks up where it left off, basically.
Has this happened to you before?
Yeah, in order to install into the Kotlin Linux machine, there wasn't enough disk space to just directly build that data make clean as you go. But that actually works, strangely enough. It works fine.
So this is what we might refer to as a monolithic distribution, because Sage comes with its own version of Python, its own version of all the Python libraries, its own version of all the, you know, like there's GAP and all those programs. And so there's some pros to doing this method. And the first one is that, yeah, we can make Sage run in its own little, it doesn't have to know about anything else, basically. We don't mess with the user's install. And the user's install shouldn't mess with Sage, although apparently there are cases where that happens.
Yeah. As very subtle, annoying part.
And this is a pro that it, and it's a con at the same time, that it doesn't integrate with the environment. It's a pro because we don't have to worry about anything else. It
doesn't change the environment.
Right.
Integrating with changing.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so then the main thing is it almost just works on a variety of platforms because it doesn't require anything outside of it. So, but the cons to that is that it doesn't integrate with the environment again because you want to be able to you take advantage of the user's existing install, their existing Python libraries. For example, William was talking about Soya 3D to do 3D visualizations. Right now, as it is, let's say I install using my standard package system on my Ubuntu machine to the Soya 3D library. And
which is trivial.
Which is real easy to do. One line of one command. And I want Sage to take advantage of that because somebody's writing an interface to Sage to make nice, pretty 3D graphics which you can kind of fly through or something. Right now, that won't work. Sage will need to have its own version of that Python module. So yeah, and then it builds everything on its own, which takes up a lot of disk space, and users will have two copies of these sometimes. And we don't want to do that. And it's 50 megabytes of source code, the toggle right now, which is a fair amount. And we can do better than that. So there's this thing that's in progress called Sage LibDist, or library distribution. And the main idea is, wouldn't it be nice to have a Sage that installs just like a normal Unix application?
And just to add, the goal isn't to change what we have now, it's to have both options.
Right.
The pros and cons are disappear when you have, if you have both options, then
you can choose which one is best for your environment and your setup.
So we're just going to support both.
And I hope that this is useful to people. I think it would be. I think people will want this. So
it also takes quite a while to compile.
Yeah, that's another good point. And yeah, it takes this takes right. This would take a lot, not nearly as long, because it still has to compile something, but it's not as bad.
That's right.
So what happens is,
plus it's way easier to make a good Ubuntu package when you have something set up like this. Or maybe it's not easier, but it's better.
Right. But yeah, the Ubuntu people won't be as angry, basically, because we won't be duplicating all sorts of stuff. Right. So all you do is you run sage-libdist, and it takes a standard Sage source, untars it, eliminates software that's commonly available.
Have a check to see if there's a duplication. Is that the idea, or would you have to tell it?
Well, it doesn't even check to see if there's a duplication. It doesn't see if your machine currently has that. When it does this -libdist.
There's a file that I wrote that lists things that are commonly available, and it just doesn't put those in the libdist.
Okay, so for example, assumes that you have them.
Yeah.
It doesn't check to see whether you have one.
That's right. That's right.
But we will do that kind of checking later. But it's not at this point when we build this used to be called the minimal distribution because it didn't contain all the extra junk, all the redundant.
But basically there's a subset of about half of the things included with Sage that's commonly available in many Linux distributions. And people put a lot of work into making those easy to install over, like Python. And the other half of them are basically written by mathematicians. Mathematicians suck at package management stuff, basically. So it's not so good there.
So the standard way of installing this is to untar the package, download the package, untar it, and then run Python setup.py install, and the install script checks for a few dependencies. So make sure you have a couple of the things that it doesn't come with, not everything, but some of the stuff that's required to build, it checks for, and then. It builds Sage without those dependencies if those are met, and then you can run Sage, and it runs it from the from the standard Unix Python interpreter, rather from a Python interpreter that came with Sage, and it runs from the standard GAP that's installed on your system rather than the GAP that came with Sage, etc.
Yeah. But basically, the feel is you just run Python, and now you have an extra library you can import called Sage.
Yeah.
So you can write any Python, take any of your pre-existing Python code or whatever and say import Sage, and then suddenly you have Sage functionality too. So you get that.
So this is a good start, and it's a work in progress, but there's some problems towards achieving that goal of making it play nice with Linux, basically. So it still runs from its own build directory. We need to make it install, and actually we're working on that today, but it still doesn't do it quite the right way. And that was with we need some sort of version of make install. And yes, if you have any experience packaging Unix software, especially non-standard Unix software, let me know, because there's all sorts of conflicting information on the internet about this, and there's various sources, and it's somewhat of a nightmare trying to wade through it all. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about standard package management Unix distributions. So they come with their own package management system, and with that they come with thousands of applications. So in the Windows world, you have to go out and buy something if you wanted to, get a software installed on your system, and you need to, who knows if it will work, and it's supported by the one company that you bought it from. Now, in the Unix world, or Linux world, I should say, any software that you want to run is available by typing a simple command. And it really does work, especially on some Linux distributions. So like, you type an apt get install Octave in Debian or Ubuntu, and there you go. Octave's now installed. It really works well. And it's very convenient for the user, obviously, because you don't have to do anything besides notice the command. So we'd like to have Sage installed this way, be installed this way, and I probably would, you know, double the number of people who would use Sage just from that, or maybe even more, if you could have that available like that.
Orders of magnitude.
Yeah, orders of magnitude more. I'm just being more conservative, but yeah, probably a lot more people. So.
And that generally just means open source mass software, because Sage is just.
Right, and that would also open up all sorts of, someone was talking about Macaulay 2 installed, so that would open that up, for example. And then the goal is to have this, so you have your prompt, type in apt get install Sage, and then it's installed. So the first try, we were going to make a package with a Linux distribution called Ubuntu. And why are we using Ubuntu? Well, it has a very large user base, despite its relative youth. It just came along recently.
It's running on right here. Right?
Yeah, it's running on right here. It's geared for the desktop as opposed to the server. So a lot of desktop sort of applications are out there, and it's well used by the kind of people who be using Sage. It runs the Debian apt dev package management system, which is, it works pretty well. It does a very good job of making sure dependencies are met. And William and Alex use Ubuntu, so that's another good reason. And I use Ubuntu, so that's another good reason. And so, okay. So right now there are, well, I mean not right now, but there are two different types of Debian packages, source and binary. And what you do is, to make a binary package, you take source package and first you build it, and then that turns it into a binary package, basically. So first we need to make a source package. So we start with a standard tarball and untar it into a directory, a working directory. You run this script called dhmake, which Debianizes the directory. And all that really means is it makes a new subdirectory called Debian, which includes some files, a whole list of files, but there are some main important ones, and those are the four most important.
Is this
like
No, this is standard. This is how you're supposed to.
It's one of the things you can apt-get.
Yeah, you can apt-get dh-main. And the control file is where the kind of the magic happens, because it contains the dependencies. So for Sage, this is hypothetical at this point. This isn't actually for a real package, but it would depend on Python 2.4, so it would make sure that you have Python 2.4 installed and Flex installed, etc. And it can flex with, so if Sage didn't work with something, it'd make sure that we can't have both of them installed at the same time. And it suggests that we have GCC and replaces some other package that might be used in place of Sage, possibly. So there's a lot of options. It's a very robust system for packaging software. And so to make a binary package, we need a make file, what I was talking about with this GNU autoconf stuff. And ideally, that make file is then taken by dh underscore that dh underscore make script and turns it into an executable make file, which just calls make on its own, called runs. And it tries to give us, yeah, this nice one. And if something is complicated as Sage, we have 14,000 files to install. We need some more custom engineering. So if anyone knows a good way of doing this, we kind of talked about this, or we kind of got our way around this in the hour before the talk. But so once we have the install rules, where the correct install rule for the make file, we're in good shape. And ideally, there's these programs called like Lint and various other Debian tools that check to make sure the package works properly. And we run this command, and it creates a binary dev file out of it. And then we'll add our own repository, which contains that file, so that users can add that to their sources.list, and they will be able to do apt-get install sage. So in the near future, we plan to add these things. And so part of the problem is that the Debian package management system is so robust that even the little intro guide for making a simple package is 59 pages long. And so planning to read through this, hopefully it'll become a little more obvious once we see it. We plan to get a simple Sage monolithic Debian package running, which it already is as of an hour ago, sort of.
Which we'll demo, yes.
Test it a bunch, put together a Sage live disk, so once you have the monolithic going, we can make something that'll be even better for you, for users who want to integrate with their system, and create some custom app repository. So users will add it, and eventually, in the far-ish future, it will get added to the standard testing universe of Ubuntu. So right now, that would be the Dapper universe. But I'm sure by the time we get to that point, it'll be something else. And then eventually it'll be, hopefully we can port these efforts to Gentoo and Slackware and Think and Red Hat and Mandrake and whatever else there are out there. Fedora. And so that's it as far as talk. And I will tab. Whoa, that's what's going on here. Okay, so.
I have to do it because.
Oh, do you need root?
Yeah, I have to take it. Okay, so there's the file. Oh, one thing I do is contents or info.
Yeah, so there's that file, that red thing there is the actual archive, the actual package. And that was created by Dan.
Yeah. So this is information about it.
So that's a binary.
That's a binary dev.
Yep, and it exists. So now watch, I'll install it. Sudo dpkg install sage.
We don't have it. We built this
about 5 minutes before 4 o'clock, so it's never ever been installed before. So I'm sure it won't work, but we'll see. Okay, so it's working just like any other Ubuntu package so far. Unpacking it. It's
pretty big.
That's something like 80 megabytes, and then it extracts to a 276. Total. But this does not. This is not something that's supposed to install nicely into your environment. No. This is not the live disk version. This installs in user share Sage basically.
So does it basically this? The end result is the same as if you just compiled it in some directory.
Basically, yeah. Except that this will have much better dependency
typing,
testing and stuff. What's your question or comment?
Send your page.
Okay. Okay. Instead of putting in user share. Well,
yep.
It would be a good idea to put an opt for something that's
it would be, yeah.
Yeah,
this is
you're right.
Minutes
you're right.
Before.
Right.
So here, this user bin sage is the one we just installed. And that's the first time you ever run sage, it gives a syntax warning, which hopefully will go away. So it successfully installed.
Why did the sync think you were trying to exit?
What?
So do you really want to exit?
Oh, it asked you. I mean, because I'm hitting. I say quit.
It doesn't ask you that every time.
It's configurable, but what if you hit Control D, for example, that's quit. So what if you're like you have this massive thing you've been working for an hour, you accidentally bump Control D, and you're suddenly kicked out of the system. That would be kind of annoying. So it at least confirms exit. But there's a config file that turns that on or off. So
and now
the other. Oh right, we have to remove it. Apt-get remove. Sage.
And see, 283 megabytes. Sage is gone.
Yeah, user bin sage, no such file or directory. So it's good. And then I guess the other demo thing is we can actually just sort of as you make your final comments. This runs basically after setting up the makefile correctly. These are the two commands you run, dhmake and this other thing. So it takes like 5 minutes or something to build the entire D package, but I'll start it going so you can sort of see it doing its thing. So it's just sitting there doing all kinds of stuff to build the package. So I'll make some closing remarks as it builds the packet.
So, so in the near future, like I said, I'm going to be working on this and hopefully make it so that everyone will just turn on their, you know, will install Linux, and there will be Sage sitting in the package repository, and then with their curiosity, be like, oh, what's that? And install it.
And same with Cygwin.
Yeah, so hopefully it'll be in Cygwin and other things, so that Windows users will be able to run it with Cygwin, and yeah.
Is there any way to make a Windows, like, without Cygwin, Sage binary, or is executable that doesn't use Cygwin?
Let's see, you can run Codex, you can run VMware, you can copy Cygwin 1.dll and a couple other DLLs into a directory. And that will work.
You should be able to do it with minimal Cygwin DLLs. Yeah.
You can copy just a huge number of Cygwin DLLs the same directory into the Sage thing, and then it's really almost just like taking C colon / Cygwin and tying that up.
Yeah.
Those are the options. A fourth option is MinGW, which is a total nightmare. MinGW, even compiling Python using MinGW, is almost impossible. So it's really ridiculous to think you can compile all Sage. At one point, I did have a distribution of Sage that Sage was simpler. MinGW is GCC, but without Cygwin.
It's GCC and binutils and whatever else the GNU build tools.
What about options like PyTuneX?
There is a Python library as part of Sage, but a lot of Sage is software that's developed by, a significant important piece of Sage is something called MWA. It's a C++ program written by a guy in England who uses it for his research, and he builds binaries for Linux. He does all his development on Linux. He doesn't care at all about anything besides Linux, and it has nothing to do with Python even. So,
and it's not portable.
And that has to be part of, and that is part of, I wrote his autocomp stuff, for example, and it has to be part of Sage, so PyTXC isn't really helpful for that, because you have to build that somehow.
Okay.
It might be possible under MinGW, but you'd also have to build GMP and a lot of things.
Right.
So there's a guy, Gary Zabakis, who made an MSI installer for Cygwin Sage, which you can run independent of installing Cygwin, and it packages DLLs. He said he made one, and that he's uploading it tomorrow.
Awesome.
He's a Windows. He's like a professional Windows programmer that's taking a year off to teach kids and stuff and work on Sage. And there should be something like that.
That's very cool.
Very nice to use the Nullsoft installer, whatever that one is.
Yeah.
The one that's made by.
There have been a couple over the last few months, but I think Gary's the best at this. People have made some installers.
Yeah.
But I mean, basically you can take almost anything out of Cygwin. It's just a native Windows program that requires some DLLs, and you just put those near the program in the appropriate place. So Cygwin isn't too bad. I mean, I've been extremely torn about how Sage should run for Windows between VMware, Colinux, and Cygwin. And I was all for Colinux until I watched the blue screen of death in the stable version, and now I'm and also there's networking issues that are pretty annoying. Whereas Cygwin, the networking issues disappear, and I've never seen Cygwin blue screen with that computer.
So there.
Extendus made the package.
We didn't have the PGP key, but it's okay.
There now exists at least a really bad, but
yeah.
Existing package.
Something.
For Sage, for W. So.
Any other question?
What were you saying about the user share compared to op or something?
Oh, as you said, it's in the Linux world, it's kind of convention that if you have a huge monolithic package, I guess it's all in opt. And then you write various shell scripts to set up the environment. So you get sourced and use it. For example, I think Mathematica itself is an opt.
Well, Mathematica just asks you where you want.
But it's like yourself in fault.
Probably.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was like. But I think like OpenOffice is not.
But not on Ubuntu. Yeah. On Ubuntu, there's nothing.
On Ubuntu, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, OpenOffice goes somewhere else.
There's absolutely nothing in Opt.
I don't use Ubuntu.
What do you use?
Arch.
Oh, okay.
Not very popular.
But it seems like once you've made an Ubuntu package, you'll be able to make, if you've done it right, then you'll be able to make anything.
Right. Well.
Different going to like RPMs would be.
Yeah, but I mean, just, well, first, I think you said there's a tool that will be.
Yeah.
Say for a tool that if you can do it for one, you'll do it for a whole bunch.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of prerequisites about how a package should be built using Mink and AutoCom tools and how it should interact with the environment. Once you figure that out for any of them, then the rest should follow easily using Mink check install. So I guess you said there's an ultimate tool for that.
And is there a way, is there an easy way to disable specific features of Sage and enable them?
No.
Because you can
no,
you
know,
there's absolutely nothing like that. Configure scripts, you can say enable this feature, disable this feature.
Right.
And it'd be really nice to be able to create a very small Sage, like the smallest possible Sage install for distributed clients, so you don't have to download a 300 megabyte code on its image to run it, because then no one will want to do it.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
But I mean, I'm sure that's something that you can configure for it.
Right.
After you did black magic of Autosuggles.
Yeah.
Sage is not a little, I mean,
yeah.
There's Paris, for example, which is a 2 megabyte source of our volume, built with very little differences. And, you know, many years they spent optimizing things so it's a small, self contained program. There are a lot of programs like that. Sage doesn't have that at all, it's cool. Because very much you don't want to reinvent the wheel. Or Sage is all about not reinventing the wheel, but it ends up being big as a result. There's just a lot of basic. When you write for Sage, you want to be able to assume that singular is there and cap is there and so on. If you build a Sage that doesn't assume that, it'll sort of randomly break all kinds of things.
Yeah.
You know what you're doing.
So any other questions, comments? Okay.
So thank you.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to see if you guys could talk next, like you and Robert, next Thursday.
I don't know. We don't have anything that is because
How
far are you?
An entire week.
Well, it's also finals day.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
How
far are you into integrating
GM?
Well, it's like, I mean, there's not much to integrate.
So it's already sent there. You can call it. It'll do its thing, and you just say, GMP factor this.
Yeah, it's an optional package installed in it.
By the way,
I got my machine online a few hours ago, a 16 processor.
Awesome, then we can run 16 clients on it, and then see how well it works.
I'm giving accounts to any Sage developers, so just write to me.
What is this?
And I'll add an account.
Until it's running a wire server on it.
Like you have a terabyte disk.
Yeah.
Stuck on it.
So it's more like writing rapidly. Really easy to use instead of like passing.